We have members here today that opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 874. And Paul, let's get started.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Paul Phillips, representing Nike. Today I have a number of three individuals here that will come up and testify right after me. I would just open the remarks with appreciation to you for working with us in DOR for helping us through this process and the Governor's Office for facilitating that process. We've arrived at what we believe is a fair and easy solution of administering and determining residency, and that would be to tie to what we would call a federal reconnect. The issue comes forward in that of 17 companies having employees that worked overseas and treating these individuals who worked overseas as we would treat the same people who might move to another state. That's essentially what we're trying to do. The bill was amended in the House, in the Senate to go back to January 1, 1995, the suggestion of the Department of Revenue. It passed out of that the Senate committee unanimously and passed with 22 votes on the floor of the Senate. With that, Mr. Chair, because you've got a busy agenda, what I thought I would do is ask representatives of Sequent and of Nike and a private CPA to come forward and testify as to the reasons for the bill, how it would actually work, and then we will stand ready for questions if that's satisfactory with you.
That sounds good.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Chair Strobeck and members of this committee. My name is Paula Flambeck. I'm Nike's International Tax Manager. I'm here today to represent Nike, Inc. Nike, Inc. has over 250 U.S. citizens on overseas work assignments. Typically, these employees move overseas to their new job location, take with them their families and most important possessions, enroll school-aged children in local schools, pay taxes to the foreign country, and establish new social connections, and often remain for a period of 3 years or more. Approximately 40% of Nike's expatriates remain overseas 6 years or more. The current law pertaining to taxation of persons living outside of Oregon was enacted in 1969, long before international work-related relocations were common. Taxation on these individuals is based upon each individual's domicile. Determination of domicile can be subjective, as it requires an in-depth examination of a taxpayer's facts and circumstances. If the taxpayer seems to be domiciled in Oregon and spends more than 30 days in the taxable year in Oregon, the taxpayer may be taxed as a full-year tax resident of Oregon, even if the taxpayer has been residing overseas for many years. Yet, a taxpayer with a similar fact pattern who relocates to another state may not be treated as domiciled in Oregon. As you can see, the state of Oregon places an unfair tax burden upon taxpayers working and living abroad who are not utilizing state services. Therefore, to simplify the law and achieve a fair tax, we worked with the Oregon Department of Revenue to develop Senate Bill 874. This bill uses federal tax terms to define a non-resident of Oregon and as such is similar to Federal Reconnect Oregon. Senate Bill 874 simplifies the interpretation of the law and provides similar tax treatment for employees who relocate overseas as compared to those who relocate to another state. We believe that this revision to the law can be easily administered, not be abused by aggressive taxpayers, and most importantly, be explained to taxpayers. Additionally, this bill enables Oregon to be competitive in the economy of the Pacific Rim and the world. For example, today, a citizen of California or Washington who is employed in Singapore for an extended period of time pays no state income tax. Yet, a citizen of Oregon who is employed in the same job and location may continue to pay Oregon income tax. Like California, several other states have recognized the importance of global expansion by treating their taxpayers working abroad as non-residents. As a result, multinational companies may be encouraged to select employees from these states for overseas assignments, or in some cases, relocate to these states. As you can see, this bill is fair and simplifies the law while enabling Oregon to be competitive with its specific rim neighbors and other states. This bill is good for Oregon and its citizens who join me in supporting this bill. Thank you for this opportunity to discuss Senate Bill 824. Thank you.
Thank you, Paula.
My name is David Kessler. I'm a CPA representing a coalition of taxpayers in support of Senate Bill 874. I'd like to thank Chair Robeck, members of the committee, for this opportunity to comment on this legislation. In my practice, I provide tax services to U.S. employees working in foreign countries. Senate Bill 874 would modify the definition a resident individual taxpayer to exclude certain individuals living in foreign countries. From my experience, the current law is difficult to interpret and administer and is not fair and inconsistent in its application to these individuals. As Paula mentioned, under current law, an individual will be a resident taxpayer if they are domiciled in a state and spend more than 30 days in the state during the tax year. Let's take an example. Let's say an individual moves to a foreign country on July 1 of a tax year. Let's assume that their domicile remains in the state of Oregon. That individual will be taxed for the entire year, including the period of time that they are no longer residing in the state because they had spent 30 days in the state prior to their move. The individual will be taxed even though they are no longer benefiting from the services of the state of Oregon. It's the question of domicile that creates this some of the problems with the current law. Is that domicile is a very subjective test based on an analysis of facts and circumstances. The subjectivity of this of domicile makes it difficult for individuals to plan the tax implications of their moves to foreign countries. It makes it difficult to determine how to properly prepare tax returns, and it makes it difficult for the Department of Revenue to examine tax returns. Recently, the Department of Revenue has opened a number of examinations on this matter. The primary issue is whether or not the individual has been domiciled in the state. A premise of the department's position seems to be that it's more difficult change one's domicile when a person moves to a foreign country than when they move to another state. Usually when a person moves to another state, takes up employment there, it's acknowledged by the department that domicile has changed. But in the case of people moving to foreign countries, this apparently isn't the case. And this results in some inconsistent treatment. And I don't mean to imply that the department is being inconsistent. I think that they are interpreting a law in a manner that creates an inconsistent result for people who move to a foreign country versus to another state. What is the nature of the transfers of these individuals? Most of these people will be requested to move to a foreign country to take a job in a location for an extended period of time. Most often I would say that these assignments will range from 3 to 5 years. Sometimes it's less, sometimes it's more, but 3 to 5 is kind of an average, I'd say. The individual's spouse and children move with them. The children will usually attend school in the foreign country. The individual will obtain work permits, visas, and other immigration documentation to allow them to stay for an extended period of time in the foreign country. The individual will lease a house or an apartment in the foreign country and sell or lease their former Oregon residence. They will sell their automobiles in the state of Oregon and move their household goods to the foreign country. And finally, they will pay income taxes in the foreign country as resident taxpayers, which can result in a certain level of double taxation if they remain subject to Oregon income tax. As you can see, the typical situation is permanent in nature. It's no different than when a person would move to another state to take employment in another state. Yet the individuals may remain subject to Oregon income tax, even though they do not benefit from the services of the state. Senate Bill 874 would correct the problems associated with the current law. Individuals who qualify under federal law for the foreign earned income exclusion would be considered to be non-resident during the time that they qualify for that exclusion. this would, because this would be tied to the federal law, it would be simple to administer and it would be objective. One would only have to refer to the federal return to determine whether or not the individual qualified as a resident or a non-resident. The federal provisions do require a certain amount of presence in the foreign country for an extended period of time. So individuals who were considered non-resident under these provisions would have moved to a foreign country and had to meet these requirements. In general, these requirements require that the individual have a tax home in the foreign country, that the individual have an abode in a foreign country, and the individual must meet a certain minimum amount of time in the foreign country, which usually is at least about a year before they can qualify for the federal provision. Now, we have worked with the Department of Revenue on this part of the construction of the legislation, and the department has been supportive of this approach, and they've been supportive of our, we've worked together and reached a pretty good conclusion as to how this should work. I believe that this legislation would be simple to administer, it would be fair and consistent in its application, and I urge you to support the passage of Senate Bill 874. Thank you.
Thank you for your patience with all of this. You're beginning to discover the benefits of written testimony. We sometimes come and go at a fairly rapid pace, and I apologize. That may be very disconcerting to you, and I appreciate your patience with us in this process. And I'm going to apologize. Have all three of you testified?
No.
We have one more to go. Please go right ahead.
Great. Vice Chair Rasmussen and members of the committee, my name is Kathy Burning, and I'm the Director of Tax for Sequent Computer Systems and also a member of the Government Affairs Committee for the American Electronics Association. Sequent is based in Beaverton, and we're a leading provider of high-end computer systems to many large organizations both in the U.S. and worldwide. All of our products are manufactured in Beaverton, while approximately half of our total revenue is generated in sales outside the United States. The impact of expatriate assignments to economic development in the state is significant. As we have expanded globally, we have relocated employees from Beaverton to our operations in both Asia Pacific and Europe. These individuals provide technical and business assistance to our foreign operations, and they provide a bridge between headquarters and the sales operation, resulting in incremental foreign sales for the company. Sequent, along with the AEA, supports Senate Bill 874. The proposed revision and expansion of the current Oregon tax law provides companies with a more objective measure of residency for employees accepting long-term foreign assignments. We invest 2.5 to 3 times an employee's annual salary when relocating the individual to a foreign work location. Much time and effort is expended to ensure that a smooth transition happens for the employee and their family. Due to the high cost of the assignment, productivity during the assignment is critical. The current definition of residency provides little certainty to the employee as to their tax status in the state of Oregon. By tying the definition to an objective measure, such as Section 911 of the Internal Revenue Code, the employee must worry about meeting just one test and can focus on doing his or her job. This results in increased productivity for the company and makes us more competitive in a global marketplace. When talking with other AEA members in the state of Oregon, they expressed frustration as well with the current residency statute, and they agreed that Senate Bill 874 would make their companies more competitive in attracting qualified personnel to undertake these foreign job assignments. Senate Bill 874 provides certainty for the employee. It is fair and objective. It's easy to understand, and it will reduce the time the employee spends determining his or her residency status, resulting in greater employee productivity. Thank you for your time today, and I hope you join me in supporting Senate Bill 874.
Thank you all for coming. Any questions from the committee? Representative Rosenbaum?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kessler, anybody else on the panel that wants to answer it? Looks like the bill now is trying to make this change retroactive to 1995. What's the rationale for giving people all these back taxes that they've already paid back?
As I mentioned, there are a number of individuals currently under examination. As I understand, it's individuals that are employed by up to 17 companies. And because the issue is subjective, it requires an analysis of the facts and circumstances. It's very time-consuming, costly for the individual taxpayers, and we believe that making the bill retroactive would keep the Department of Revenue and the taxpayers from having to go through that process.
I'm not quite sure I understand. Are you saying that there are people who are under investigation whose status going back to 1995 is in question?
Yes.
Why? Are there people going back further than 1995 then?
There are, that I know of, there's maybe a handful of people that are 1994, but predominantly, as I understand it, it starts in 95 through 97, which would be the...
Mr. Chair, Representative, the retroactive clause was suggested by the Department of Revenue going back to the date of deficiency, so it would be fair to all taxpayers within the current period under audits. So that was their suggestion, to make the bill workable and fair for all tax people within this tax classification. That's what this amendment's for. Susan Browning from the department is here if you want to talk to her.
Representative Merkley. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have in my folder a revenue impact on this. Do we have that?
It'd be in the papers that you got today. Mm-hmm. All stapled together with the Senate.
My question is that do you have a list of the countries that have income taxes and those that don't?
Do I have a list?
Mm-hmm.
I do not.
It's my impression there are a number of countries that do not have income taxes that apply to Americans working in those countries. And I was wondering if you have a sense of those that do and don't.
Well, I will say there are some countries that do not impose an income tax or and also some that may be imposed a small income tax. Those are very few. And in my experience, the individuals that go overseas on these assignments, go work in countries, and most of them are industrialized countries, some are not, but all of these countries impose significant income taxes, and in many cases, they're far in excess of what would be imposed by the U.S. or the state, and the state of Oregon.
In that case, would you consider it reasonable if we just made those income taxes a deduction against what is owed in Oregon State income taxes? And this would put us in a situation where someone went overseas where there was no income tax, where the person would still be carrying their share, but we wouldn't be double taxing anyone in the way that you've noted.
That it question is one of fairness of the individuals overseas. They may, in fact, no longer be domiciled in the state of Oregon, and certainly would not be benefiting from the services of the state. So I guess I don't follow that.
So your argument isn't really double taxation. It's that they really have no responsibility while overseas for the affairs going on back home.
Correct. And there is an inconsistent treatment between how an individual that moves to another state is taxed versus an individual who moves to a foreign country. The individual that moves to the other state is no longer subject to Oregon income tax, but the individual that moves to a foreign country may be, depending upon the circumstances.
That was my observation, is that if I moved to a state that didn't have an income tax, but I was still an employee of an Oregon company, but I lived in another state, they wouldn't say, well, because there's no income tax in that state, therefore you have to pay income tax in Oregon. That doesn't make any sense.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To follow up on that, an analogy would be someone who would move to the state of Washington, where they don't have an income tax, But isn't it true that the employees that are working in the state of Washington are paying other taxes that are reasonably equivalent to what the income tax would be in Oregon? So I would assume that in foreign countries where there might not be an income tax, there's other taxes that those employees are subject to that probably are equivalent to the income tax in Oregon.
Some of these countries have value-added taxes, which are similar to the sales tax, up to 20% on goods purchased.
Mm-hmm. Other questions? For me, the part that is most, I think is most irritating is the fact that if somebody spends 30 days out of the year in Oregon, that the department has then been jumping to the conclusion that therefore you're a full year resident. And, you know, I have some personal involvement with this. Nike and Sequin are both in my district, but also, he's, you know, my brother-in-law works for Nike, and he and his whole family moved to Taiwan and then later to the Philippines. And when he came back, he was hit with this, oh, by the way, there, you know, you moved over there in June, and the second year you had meetings that totaled more than 30 days back in the States. So therefore, you owe full year taxes for each of those years, even though they were paying in the Philippines. And it just seems totally unfair.
Mr. Chair?
No,
I agree with that. I guess I had understood the department really wasn't enforcing or collecting this on that consistent basis. Is that part of the issue, though, too?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative, the issue really came to a head as a result of an audit that started in 1997 and identified an inconsistency within the law and practice, and that then raised these companies and to work with the Department of Revenue and ultimately come forward to you with this legislation that would resolve what we think is an inconsistency. And our inconsistency is not a criticism of the department.
Right.
It's just this bill was passed in 1969, I believe, and the economy and things have changed and the application is different now than it was then.
Well, I think also there's a little question specifically about internal workings within the department, because I called and talked to, I was referred to somebody who was the person who identified themselves as the head of the section that dealt with this kind of issue, and they said we would never single out particular companies for, you know, we wouldn't go after a company, and yet I think the testimony was that there were 60 to 80 people at Nike who got the very same notice at virtually the same time. Now, that doesn't seem like just a coincidental across-the-board audit. Thank you very much.
Okay, in summary,
Susan Browning, do you want to say something else in defense? Since I have a semi-maligned the agent.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Susan Browning, Department of Revenue. And there were a couple issues that were brought up, and if I may, I'll just respond to each of them as we go through. I believe Representative Rosenbaum asked about the retroactivity piece of the bill. The initial bill stated that it was for tax years beginning on or after January 1st, 1996, and to any tax year for which a notice of deficiency may be issued on the effective date of this 1999 Act. We did have notice of deficiency back to 1995. So we felt the department felt in order to be fair to those people who had been complying with the law as it's written now, back in 1995, it would be important to give them the same relief that this bill gives to those individuals that have a notice of assessment. Otherwise, for those people in 1995, if you had complied with the law as it's written now, you wouldn't be able to get this relief. But if we had issued a notice of assessment, you would. So there was an inequitable treatment department felt for that group of people that's out there for 95. So that's why we asked that the one more year be added on to that piece, treat them the same. The issue that the committee...
Can I ask a question about that before we go forward? But those folks who paid the tax in 95 and didn't, you know, research it and paid what they were supposed to, they wouldn't have received a notice of assessment or notice of deficiency.
That's correct. Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, and that was our concern with the original bill. If the bill was originally written, it was 1996 or if the individual had a notice of assessment. And there were some notice of assessments out for 1995. So in essence, you could be treating a group of people from 1995 differently. If they had complied,
they would not get relief. If they had a notice of assessment because they had not complied with the current law, they would get relief. We felt that that was not appropriate, that all those taxpayers should get relief.
So anyone who paid could file an application or revise amended return and file. Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, under the bill as it is now, those people for 1995 could file an amended return and get a refund back. We also ask that the refund provision be put in here for those people who had filed according to the current law. We could get their money back to them so they get the same kind of relief.
To further clarify this then, your recommendation regarding this language didn't have to do with going back in time. It was if we went back in time to make a fair between those who paid and those who we would like to have paid.
Mr. Chair, Representative Martin, exactly. We felt that the taxpayers, whether they paid or not paid for whatever year you chose to start this, should be treated the same.
Okay.
There should not be a distinction made between those two groups of people.
Thank you.
There really is no distinction in our mind. The other, I think Mr. Phillips portrayed our role in this bill correctly. We had an opportunity to work with the sponsors of the bill on this and look at their initial draft. Our concern was how complex the original proposal was. We went out and looked at five other states that have similar provisions, and Minnesota has one that appears to work well, and this is what you have in the bill here, the linkage with the federal code. So we are interested in it was making sure it was clean and easy for the taxpayers to understand. I believe Senate Bill 874 does that. It's clear how you're to report and comply. The question that I believe was raised as well is the application. The law, the Department of Revenue is charged with administering the law as it's written, and the law says currently a resident is a person who maintains a permanent place of abode in Oregon, does not maintain a permanent place of abode elsewhere, and lives in Oregon more than 30 days in a year. And that's how we get into some of these areas which you've been discussing here today. It doesn't really make a distinction between whether you live abroad or whether you live in Minnesota during that period of time. So it is a discussion of domicile. The one issue that I really would like to respond to is how does the department become involved in this issue? And I really want to stress that we do not target industries, we do not target companies, we look at individual taxpayers. The auditor became aware of this when she was looking at some returns and looking at those people who had claimed foreign earned income credit and how they complied with the law, what we call the stub years, the year that they left for their overseas assignment and then the year they returned. The time that when they're overseas, if they're over there and don't return more than 30 days to Oregon, they are non-resident. So if you go to Japan, you leave in July, you're over there for 3 years, those 3 years would be full tax years, would be non-resident. But the year you leave, if you leave in July, you'd be considered a full year resident because you're here more than 30 days. In the same way, if you return back in June, that year you come back. So it primarily affects people from the years they leave and the year they come back, primarily on their overseas assignment. That's where we capture a lot of this. So the department was looking at how people were reporting individually on that. And because of the nature, and I think you heard from the people who spoke with you before, because of the nature of their business, many of the employees that are in this position, individuals, work for a few companies. But we looked at the individuals and did not look at where they were working. We were treating them as individual personal income taxpayers. There were about 17 companies that are represented in this group, and they're probably or more. We kind of stopped at that point because we knew there was some interest in changing this. So we put basically everything on hold until you had an opportunity to review this and consider what you wanted to do with it. But I would really, really stress, and it's very important to the department to make that clear, we worked backwards. We worked with the individuals and worked back. It still happens for the majority. A large number of them do work for a couple companies because those companies do have such a large overseas presence and a lot of their staff was overseas to represent them for extended periods of time.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Murphy.
If I'm the primary wage earner for my family or the only wage earner, and I go overseas and my family stays here, how does this then come into play? Would I still be able to be exempt from taxation under this law even if my family was here living in the state?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy. The definition really is tied into what the Federal Internal Revenue Code would say. You would be taxed as a non-resident from the time you leave until the time you return. If you meet certain criteria, you would have to establish that you're a bona fide resident of the country, foreign country, and that you have been over there extended period of time. So you could become a qualified individual by actually changing your home to that foreign country or by being physically present in that country for a period of time. So it's a little bit more, it's a cleaner test. It doesn't get in the domicile issue or the intent piece as much. It would depend a lot on.
But it really depends on where the wage earner is located. Their family could still be in the state here, and it wouldn't have any impact on.
Mr. Chair, members, Representative Merkley, what I think is attractive about the solution that's in Senate Bill 874 is that you would need to meet the federal test. So if you meet for the federal test, you meet that definition, and your circumstances that you portray creates you as a qualified individual. That would ripple through to Oregon, and you could be considered a qualified individual for Oregon as well.
Thank you.
So it really is there's two different tests than what we have currently with the permanent place of abode, no permanent place of abode elsewhere, and living in Oregon more than 30 days to be a resident. It really shifts it into a kind of a test where you actually have to change your home. That's probably the issue you're getting into is probably the definition of changing your home to a foreign country or by being physically present for a certain period of time. And there's a scenario you presented. This person could probably meet the qualification of being physically present for a certain period of time during the year in that foreign country, so they probably would qualify, I would think. But it depends a lot on individual circumstances here, too.
Ms. Browning, so it sounds like under the scenario of the bill, Oregon would not make a determination. We would simply accept whatever the federal government.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, that's correct. That's why this we led to recommending this solution. New York has had this kind of treatment for several years, but theirs is very, very complex, and the state has to really get involved in a lot more determination about number of days and a lot of different factors. This is really easy to administer because it is linked to the federal. So if you meet the federal, you qualify for the federal, to their satisfaction, then we would just accept it so it's more of a connection type arrangement.
Yes.
And you said that five other states do what this bill suggests. It's linked to the federal.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, five other states treat individuals who are on overseas assignments differently for residency purposes. Only Minnesota has the tie to the federal. The other states we looked at have their own tests. They've got different kind of tests they build in, but they're attempting to accomplish the same end result that Senate Bill 874 is getting to. It's a little more complex, the different tests they have, though. But so to accomplish the same result, which is to treat the taxpayers who are on overseas assignments similar to 874, they do different things. Minnesota just seems to be the cleanest because it does have the linkage to the tie.
And what about the 45 other states? They do what we are currently doing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, I do have
a... Tell me what for our Department of Revenue.
I do have information, and I don't have it with me right now, about what the other states do. The five states that, as I recall, that do this do have significant overseas relationships with the type of economy and businesses they have. So perhaps they have more of an interest in that area. But I can certainly get you that information about what the other states do. We did compile that as well. I might even have it back there.
Other questions? Okay, thanks very much. Anybody else here to speak on Senate Bill 874? If not, I'll close the public hearing and then open the work session on Senate Bill 874.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Witt?
I would move Senate Bill 874A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Witt moves Senate Bill 874A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Rasmussen?
I think it's probably a pretty reasonable thing to do here, but I do know that there's a $3 million revenue hit, especially in this biennium when we're trying to figure out how we're going to fund things like higher ed and K-12. Is there any sense of how we're going to reconcile these giveaways and the other things that all of the tax budget we've passed out of this committee with that end goal of how we're going to fund and balance the budget?
that a specific question?
Mm-hmm.
And to whom are you addressing that?
You. The closest thing to authority I can see in the room.
Yes, I think, as you know, there's a reconciliation process that balances revenues with expenditures. And, Ed, why don't you explain what this actual $3
million
is? That's not necessarily lost revenue specifically.
Well, Mr. Chair, what the analysis assumes is that about $800,000 per year in tax revenues will be affected by this change. And in the first biennium, because of the retroactivity provision, there will be some additional effects. And it's a little note at the bottom of the box in the revenue impact table there gives the rationale. There are additional $400,000 per year. So about half the annual impact is assumed to accrue in each of the retroactive years. And it's also assumed that all of that will probably get, so if amended returns will get filed, so if refunds will be made during the 1999-01 biennium, along with the exclusion of bad income from Oregon taxation in the 1999 and 2000 tax year.
But if people were not paying those taxes, or had not paid them, assuming they were not considered full-year residences, what happens to that? Are you predicting that that would just not be collected?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. That isn't factored into this analysis. Mm-hmm. This is based on taxpayers who filed full-year returns under current law and
are due refunds, essentially.
And would, under this change, be due refunds.
So that, that is a real hit. That's not like money we've already forgone. What the heck? This is money that have been collected and we would be sending back.
Right. It would have been collected improperly, incorrectly.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Merchant.
I would propose that we change it to tax years beginning on January 1st, 2000, make it as a clean implementation of a new principle going from here forward.
Any other discussion?
I mean, that would be one solution to a $3 million hit.
Further discussion?
Consider that as a good concept.
I guess I'm proposing a conceptual amendment to change it from January 1st, 1995 to the year 2000 under provision section 2.
Well, we have a motion on the floor. Is Representative Witt, are you willing to amend your motion?
No, I'm not, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Further discussion on the motion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Merkley?
I haven't had a case made for going back other than to say that the Department of Revenue proposed it. The Department of Revenue has noted that what they really did was to make the case that if it went backward in time for people to whom a letter of deficiency had been filed, that we should then go backward in time for everyone else. I guess I'd like to hear the argument for why we should go backward in time at all with this tax provision.
Mr. Chair?
In general.
Well, it seems to me if we're making the policy determination that this approach, this method is not appropriate tax or public policy, then it seems inconsistent to me to make that determination, but say at the same time to those from whom we have collected these funds, thanks, we'll keep them.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's to me, it seems that's the justification for making it retroactive. If we're going to make that determination, then we should make it effective to those who have paid into this as well, at least for a reasonable period of time prior to the effective date here.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I would echo that. This is a question of fairness for these taxpayers, and if we are making the determination that it was inappropriate to tax them, then it certainly is unfair because we've collected these dollars or assessed these dollars that we're going to keep them. Now, this is a matter of basic fairness once we've made the determination on policy.
Please.
Please.
Well,
I would respectfully disagree with my colleagues. I think that fairness argument is essentially what everybody has made who's come in front of us, whether we've accepted it or not, that they're not being treated fairly under the current tax code and want to be treated more preferentially. And to date, I'm not aware that we've done that for years retroactively. So I'm not quite sure what is different about this group. I'm not particularly persuaded that it's necessarily bad policy to continue doing what we're doing now, but I would be more favorable. We're not giving the money back several years retroactively.
Ms. Browning, can you help us? there have been other cases where a policy has been changed that then also involves retroactive corrections to other taxpayers, has there not?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there have been times when we've gone back, like the federal retiree issue is one that comes to mind because of the court decision that's impacting past years. So the department has gone back and opened those up all the way back to 91. So we are issuing refunds for those. So the department's contention on this was simply that no matter where you start, let's make sure we get all the taxpayers in that group, whether they comply with current law or not, and move them along together. We could certainly issue the refunds if that's what you wish, and go back and make sure we try and identify all those people who have paid in and make sure we get the money back to them. And we have the language within the 874 that allows us to do that, so we can open up the older years and get people's money back. Because we need to treat them fairly, no matter how you start that. And if you wish to make it prospective, starting 2000 or wherever, we would continue to collect on those that we have assessments out, because we do need to ensure that we administer the current law and comply with what you want to do now. So we can continue forward with the assessments that we have identified through the audit process. That's kind of the two choices, I guess I would say. We can do either one you would prefer.
Mr. Chair?
Thank you for
it. Maybe this is already discussed, I missed it, but why was the 1995 date chosen as opposed to 96 or 94? I think that might help you know. Do you know?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kafori, as I mentioned, the initial bill said January 1st, 1996, or if there was a notice of assessment out there. Some of the notice of assessments that we're talking about here go back to 1995. So you have a group of people who would who go back to 1995 if you have a notice of assessment under the original bill. But if you complied for 1995 and you, with the current law, and you paid, you wouldn't have any relief. So there was kind of a window there where some people would be not treated fairly, I think, and not get the tax relief. So if you wanted to go back with the open notice of assessment that we have out, it would be to 1995, so you could pick up those people who had complied and paid, so we could get them refunds back as well.
So you'd also have a group of people in that notice of assessment class, some of whom had paid and some of whom hadn't paid. This bill would say to the ones who hadn't paid, you're off scot-free, and unless we put this retroactive clause in, the ones who had paid, we would keep the money, as Rick Shadley said. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, under my proposal...
Can I have the response, please?
Let me see if I understand, Representative Strobeck. The ones that we have out currently, where the auditor went through and selected those, she actually identified returns where there's a foreign earned income exclusion, where it looked like they were reporting an error by filing a part year during the years of departure and return. And so then she identified some of those. She's identified those and contacted the taxpayers. And some of them happen to work for, more than one of them works for certain companies. Okay. So those are the ones we have out currently. So those are on the table. And as I said, we put them on hold pending this legislation so that we can meet whatever you wish to do. If you decide to go forward with the bill as it is, with the 95 or notice of assessment, what we'll do is we'll just dismiss those notice of assessments that we've identified for that group of people. And then we'll identify and contact those people who have already paid since 1995 under this provision and who would get relief. We'd identify those people and issue them a refund for the amount of money they paid.
So my question was, people who got that notice of assessment and who didn't pay?
Who have not yet paid.
Who have not yet paid. If this bill passes...
We would not pursue
payment, but also if this bill didn't pass with the retroactive clause, so people who did pay would lose. they would not be contacted and they'd not have the ability to file a refund claim. So in other words, right. People who delayed would be able to keep the money. The people who paid would lose the money, even though they were in the same class.
Mr. Chair, if this bill did not pass, those people that have the notice of assessments out who have not paid, we would still continue to get collection from them because they did not comply with the existing law as of that time, as of 1996 or 97 or 98. So they have not complied. They haven't paid, but they should pay. There's a point we would take. If we would go back and continue, we would open them up again and say, okay, the legislature's decided they do not want to deal with the past years. They want to go prospectively forward. So you didn't comply with existing law at the time.
As it was.
As it was. Mm-hmm. And it's not retroactive, so you still owe this. We need to collect it, so we will go out and collect it. And then most people have already paid are all right. I mean, they're basically held harmless because they complied with the law at the time. So we would open them up again and go back and contact these people and work with them. So that's how our two courses of operation would proceed.
And that would be unfair. That would be taxing some people and not taxing others for the same activity.
Mr. Chair, I think it would be fair, if I may respectfully point out, because what our role is to enforce the law as it is on the books right now, and as you've said, we should be enforcing it. So if people have paid and complied with the law as it is now, we wouldn't be pursuing them. If people have not complied and paid under the law as it is now, we have an obligation to collect and pursue that collection piece of it. If you wish to go back retroactively, we'll make sure to get the money back to those people who have refunds coming, and we'll just say, fine, you know, the legislation has determined that we shouldn't be continuing to collect on this and yet you don't have an obligation. So basically, law has changed. So that would be very clean, too.
Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Merkley.
I think there's probably consensus on this panel that taxpayers in a given tax year should all be treated equally. The question is do we go back in time or do we implement this going forward? This is the first provision of this nature in which we've decided to go back. You just raised the question of whether there are other examples, and I guess I'd like to again ask a question, Ms. Browning. You cited one example of which a court case really was the reason we went backward in time. I guess I'd like to know if there are examples not compelled by a court case, whether this is unusual. We certainly haven't proposed extending of our tax credits retroactively in time, nor to my knowledge any other provisions during the course of this session. I think that it is a bit peculiar. We make adjustments in the code all the time to fit what we feel is appropriate going forward. Clearly, we don't have an outrageous policy here. It's one held by most of the states in the nation. But we do have a significant business that we're seeking to help in this case because many of our big electronic firms do have employees in this capacity. And I suspect that all of us would like to assist them in this way, or many of us would. But do we go back in time? I mean, why not 1994? Why not 1990? It seems so. But I'd like to clarify how unusual this is.
Mr. Chair, Representative Markley, for the record, this is the Department of Revenue. I was consulting with Jim and Mary back there, too. We could think of some examples. One obvious one that comes to mind is reconnect. In the past, before you had the permanent reconnect, there was a discrepancy period of time where taxpayers were complying with the law as it was then. And then once you passed reconnect, the law changed, so we would go back and the taxpayers would amend their returns to meet the new law. So that's an example of now that you have a rolling reconnect, you don't have that issue so much because it was always a decision then for the taxpayers to determine whether they should comply with the existing law or best that the legislature is going to pass reconnect and just wait for that to happen and then have to go back. And we couldn't think of any real specific examples. I think it has occurred, and we would try to think of some others, but in the income tax area, usually comes out of like court cases or else like a reconnect example we thought of. It's certainly something we could do administratively. We can do.
Mr. Chairman,
okay,
not to belabor this issue, but I think the question here is one of fairness. If a taxpayer is working in the state of Oregon 30 or 45 days, and then they're overseas in a foreign country and they're subject to all the taxes of that country. As a matter of fairness, when we have the state of Oregon making them pay a full year of income taxes, and I don't care if it goes back 5 years, 3 years, 6 years, 10 years, and at some point you have to say we have to reestablish some fairness to this. And I think it's totally appropriate to go back to 1995 to exact some fairness for these taxpayers.
No, I think as Ms. Browning testified, that 1995 was when they started, or as far back as they have issued notices of assessment. And otherwise, other people are not, they're not being asked to pay. So therefore, there's no point in going back any further. They were not asked to pay. People back to 1995 were asked to pay. That's why that date was set. It's a very logical place to start, because that's where they started trying to enforce this provision. Okay, please call the roll.
Representative Kifori.
Aye.
Representative Merkley.
Aye.
Representative Rosenbaum.
No.
Representative Federley.
Aye.
Representative Welch.
Aye.
Representative Williams.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Vice Chair Rasmussen.
I will be voting against this bill. I'm voting no, not because I do not support the concept, but because I do not have a full, complete picture of how we're going to get out of this session.
Aye. Senate Bill 874 goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Witt, would you like to carry the bill?
I'd be happy to, Mr. Chairman.
Close the work session on Senate Bill 874. And open the public hearing on Senate Bill 2. Ed, do you want to just briefly tell us what kind of bill two is?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 2 makes some changes to the Working Families Child Care Credit, which was passed last session. Specifically, what it does is increases the maximum allowable working family child care credit for income tax filers who are between 150% and 200% of the federal poverty level. It also increases the maximum income level where the complete phase-out of the credit occurs from the current level of 200% of federal poverty level up to 250% of federal poverty level. And these changes apply to tax years beginning January 1st, 2000. And the details of the changes in the credit income limits appear on at the top of page 2 in the bill in that table. Shift the income limits out a little bit so taxpayers at a higher income level would be eligible for the credit than under current law.
Okay, thank you. Chuck, check it off.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Chuck Shekatoff of the Oregon Center for Public Policy. I'm here today in support of Senate Bill 2 with amendments to the suggested amendments to make the working family credit refundable. The 1997 legislature enacted the working family credit in a bill that also created a state earned income tax credit. The working family credit currently exists, provides the working family child care credit. It provides a credit of up to, theoretically, of up to 40% of a family's child care costs, families with incomes up to 150% of the federal poverty level. And then it phases down the credit between 150% and 200% of poverty, instead of just having a cliff effect where someone totally loses it when they get a dollar more of income. It's really considered a part of Oregon's welfare reform strategy in helping working people leave welfare and move into low-wage jobs. And child care costs are now one of the largest costs faced by a low-income working family. In the 60s, when the federal poverty guidelines were developed, it was food was the largest cost. Now housing and child care make up the largest portion of the low-income working family's costs. purpose of the bill was, besides being an important component of welfare reform, was to treat all families up to 150% of poverty the same, provide a 40% credit to those families, and then reduce it as their income goes from 150 to 200% of poverty. As noted in a paper which previously distributed to members of the committee in your offices, the credit, because it's not refundable, isn't working. The credit originally were refundable when it got to the House from the Senate. It came over here twice after the last session, after the May revenue forecast, Senate President Brady Adams moved the startup date into this biennium. It was going to start next biennium. And it became a part of the budget debate. And then when the budget reconciliation process ended a late night a few days before Shiny Die, then Chair Bryan said, okay, I need to make a $90 million credit, fill a $34 million hole. And the only way to do that was to make the two credits non-refundable. And it really wasn't a debate about what that would do. On the Senate side, there was significant debate about whether it should be refundable, and they recognized that only a refundable credit will get the benefit to the lowest income people. I may, Mr. Chair, I have an overhead which is attached to the testimony, and I'd like to explain it.
This chart shows, probably on the slide, I don't know. This chart shows what happens under current law and under Senate Bill 2. Under current law, families between 650 and around 1250 are supposed to get a 40% credit. Then it was supposed to phase down, someone hit around $13 an hour. What happens, however, is because they do not have enough tax liability, they don't get credit. Therefore, someone at 650 only getting, instead of getting a 40% credit, are getting a 1% credit. Instead of getting $3,000 back of their $7,000 child care costs, they're getting $99 back. For someone at 1150 is getting, supposed to get a 24% credit, gets a 13% credit, and they're getting more money back. In fact, the tax expenditure report talks about that over 60% of the benefits are not going, being paid out because it's not refundable. And that's actually probably an underestimate because they were looking at who tried to take the credit and couldn't take all of it. There's a lot of people who, when they got to that line, didn't have tax liability and didn't even fill it out. So it's probably even more than 60% unused. What Senate Bill 2 does is it expands the income eligibility to 250% of poverty. So people up to 1250 would theoretically have 40% credit, then phase it down to 250% of poverty. But what happens is, again, these people don't have enough tax liability. All of this money is not used. Again, if the credit is not doing that which it was designed to do, which is given even credit for people up to a certain income level, and then phase it down. It's actually sort of think of this, if what would happen if the child care division went to the Ways and Means Committee and said, you know, we want to help people with child care costs. Give us an appropriation. We'll send people money at the end of the year. If someone earns $12.50 an hour, we'll give them more money towards their child care costs than the minimum wage worker at $6.50. It probably would be laughed out of the Ways and Means process. That's what the bill's doing, currently exists. And so what a refundable credit would do is make it so that everyone gets the credit the bill was designed to get it to them. The refundable credit costs slightly less than the expansion of the income cap. And while the expansion of the income, I'm not against the expansion of the income cap, first the credit should be made refundable so that it can actually accomplish that which it's supposed to do. There's one other, besides being important for welfare reform, I should tell you that the average starting wage of someone leaving welfare right now is $7.25 an hour. You can see from that chart they're getting around a 4% credit, one-tenth of what they were supposed to get. Besides the equities and issue of whether or not the credit's doing that which it's supposed to do, there's another issue which makes making the credit refundable even more important. Federal law requires that Oregon spend a certain amount of money towards families with
dependent children, related programs in order to get our federal welfare grant, our TANF, Temporary Assistance to Needy Families Block Grant. That requirement is called a maintenance of effort. They said maintain the effort you were doing in 1994. And in fact, you don't have to maintain it 100%. We're allowed to go down to 75% of our maintenance of effort. Oregon has gone down to 75%. They're teetering there. On the Ways and Means side, the governor's revised budget released April 9th threatens the ability of Oregon to meet maintenance of effort. And some additional cuts being considered, and I don't know the details yet of the cuts you just announced a couple days ago, continue to threaten it. So Oregon may not be able to meet the maintenance of effort. Why is this important? Because the federal government finally came out with rules under the 96 welfare law 2 weeks ago. And those rules say if you have refundable earned income or child care credits or other credits that are serving this population, the cost of the refundability, my version of this bill, can be charged off the maintenance of effort. If, however, you merely pass a tax credit such as Senate Bill 2, which lowers people's tax liability, you cannot charge that maintenance of effort. So the credits are on a biennial basis or within a few million dollars. So let's say they're even. Are you going to spend $28 million and not be allowed to charge that towards our maintenance of effort to the federal government? Or do you want to spend $28 million that has the value of the Department of Human Resources saying we're spending this on the tax side meet our maintenance of effort requirement, essentially frees up general fund dollars. So if you're going to spend the money, it's an important added value of a refundable credit that I think, separate from the issues of whether people are getting the benefits they're intended. And I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Okay, thank you. Questions? Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sheketoff, I've heard some criticism generally of refundable credits. This seems to be moving us back into basically a welfare system. I'm wondering if you have a response to that.
Chair Representative Rosenbaum, I would like to respond to that. I have 2 points. First, most credits in Oregon, not all, but most have what are called carry-forward provisions. People get the credit even though they don't have the tax liability the year they file. They can use them over 3 to 5 years. Sort of varies by credit. Carry-forward provisions would not work in this situation because carry-forwards only work with the expense that you're getting a tax credit for goes down in future years so you can use the carry-forward, or your income goes up significantly so you can use it. When you have a recurring large expense that's not going down and your income isn't going up significantly, you'd never be able to get to use the carry-forward provisions. The other reason carry-forwards don't work is you have to have a accountant and keep track of the records, and it actually would add to tax error from the Department of Revenue's perspective. So carry forward would be inappropriate for a low-income credit, but a refundability is really no different than a carry forward. It's just the timing of when the person gets the money. Second, and probably more importantly, is this credit, Senate Bill 2, the existing law, is welfare for working families. There's no question about that. I'm not going to deny that. Making it refundable isn't any more welfare for working families. It's a program that's assisting families with a significant expense who are working. They have to be working, and there's a minimum amount of income they have to be working. It's not just working one day a year. I think it's $6,000, if my memory serves me correctly, of income. So it's people who are working, and the credit itself is all, like a lot of credits, is a form of welfare from the state. So refundability isn't anything more welfare than not, and it's the same as a carry forward, it's just a different timing.
Additional questions? You've referred to an amendment and to the refundable. You don't have an actual amendment. You're just suggesting that we amend the bill, is that correct?
Yes, sir. I did request an amendment when I got the original memo, but I haven't received it yet.
Okay.
I just got a chance on it.
Okay. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ellen Lowe?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Ellen Lowe. I serve as Director of Public Policy of the Ecumenical Ministry of Oregon, an organization of 16 Christian denominations representing about 1,200 congregations. I also served as chair of the Hunger Relief Task Force, and so I'm here today really wearing both hats. The Hunger Relief Task Force, which was created by statute back in 1989, instructs the task force to work toward ending hunger. And that isn't just providing food baskets, it's working toward an environment that would allow people to be able to access food and their nutritious support. Ecumenical Ministries has within its social principles a mandate to support laws that indeed support the basic function of the family, to nurture, to care, and to shelter. And both of those mandates really have these two groups looking toward refundability of tax credits as being extremely important for families in Oregon that are working, that are trying to work toward real independence, self-sufficiency, if you will. And so we look at the refundability issue as one that is welfare avoidance, as well as providing transitional help for people leaving welfare. In our experience, many of the families who come to us for emergency assistance are working, and they do not have the income that allows them to exist without some emergency support. They aren't on welfare. They are actually working. And so we look at it in two ways, welfare avoidance, as well as that kind of transitional help as people are leaving welfare. And we would consider refundability as a major contribution to welfare reform in Oregon. I will make copies and make available to you, and I think that your chair has a copy of the letter, but a letter that Doug Wilson from DHR has written to the co-chairs of Ways and Means about the risks in the maintenance of effort issue that we do have as part of welfare reform and the Oregon option. And so I'd like to reinforce what Mr. Sheketoff said about the importance of that issue, that refundability could be counted toward the maintenance of effort. And we have had testimony this week that it appears as if the cushion that is now available to us in terms of maintenance of effort is only $3.6 million. And when you look at the size of the whole TANF program, that's a very small cushion. And so refundability would be something that would help Oregon avoid some significant federal penalties. And so we would ask you to look at the amendments which will come to you tomorrow, which essentially are what you will find in Senate Bill 1190, really as a wise investment in terms of our TANF obligation, but also maybe a legal one as well in terms of that TANF obligation. And so it's on behalf of the Hunger Relief Task Force, on behalf of the Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon, and I should say that both groups were the requesters in the last session of the bill that was refundable. And so we're back again asking that you indeed look at these credits as an essential cornerstone in the building blocks for working families who are really trying to become independent in Oregon. I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Thank you, Representative Webb.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Lusso, I understand you would, given an option, you would prefer to take out the language in Senate Bill 2 and replace it using comparable dollars to make the credit refundable.
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, we believe refundability needs to be the base. And then as you look at those available dollars in that budget reconciliation process I've heard referred to before, then look at expansion. But we would see the very most important thing is refundability.
Mr. Chairman, I can follow up. So I also, I don't know if you had a chance to see the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 2. You had an opportunity to look at this?
No.
Okay, well, what they apparently do, and I, if you need more information, you need to look at it, I understand, but they apparently do is they provide a credit for non-working spouses who had been working and then made the determination to stay home with a young child, and it provides a credit. The family income has to be below $35,000, and it provides a credit for the non-working spouse. To the extent of, I think it's 10% of the income that the non-working spouse had made in the previous year. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, I would need to look at the exact language and the possible fiscal impact, but what I might suggest would be to look at the language of Senate Bill 1190, which has both the earned income credit and the working family credit becoming refundable. And one of the advantages of expanding refundability to the earned income credit is that that does then indeed become available to families that do not have paid child care. And many people living in poverty do utilize extended family, or if their children have a wide age range, other family members in child care. And so the earned income credit would be a way of targeting the kind of assistance I think you're alluding to that would go to those who were indeed low income.
Senate Bill 1190, is that an earned income credit refundability?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kafouri, Senate Bill 1190 includes both the earned income credit and the working family credit, making them refundable.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ellen, so if we pass the Dash 2 amendments that make the working credit, the working family credit refundable, then that's accomplished at least half of what Senate Bill 1190 does. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Chatterley, yes.
Or we hold this and we wait for Senate Bill 1190.
Mr. Chair, Representative Chatterley, that would be a long wait.
Thank you, Ellen.
Mr. Chair?
Representative.
So the Dash 2, Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Kafouri, the staff just retweets those from Legislative Council.
Mr. Chairman, is there what? Do we know who brought the Dash 1?
Yes, we do. I did.
Okay.
Other questions for Ms. Lowe? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jeannie Berg Rempel.
Chairman Strobeck and members of the committee, my name is Jeannie Berg-Rempel, and I'm here representing Service Employees International Union, and I've also been asked to testify on this bill on behalf of the Tax Justice Coalition, which includes SEIU and a number of other labor and community organizations. And I'd like to mention to start with Tim Nesbitt, who's also with SEIU, was on the Governor's Tax Task Force. And one of the few things that they recommended in terms of credits was that the Working Family Child Care Credit be made refundable. And we concur with that. And given that we support that, the Dash 2 amendments and the Senate Bill 2, I would also
you know, that the Tax Justice Coalition deliberated some on this because we are inclined to not support things which are newer expanded credits. And yet this one, the argument for fairness around this, this making the working family tax credit refundable was so compelling that we did support that. And I personally, as someone who's been real involved in the minimum wage issue, find the arguments for this credit very compelling. When I was working on the minimum wage ballot measure, I was asked to find minimum wage workers who were willing to talk about their situations. I found two women who shared a house. They were two single mothers with four children under four between them, and they each had two. They showed me, one of them, what their child care bill was for 1 month, and for one woman with two children that are still both in diapers, in 96 they were paying $700 a month. That's kind of difficult to do at $6.50 an hour. And so seeing, and Chuck showed you, that without responsibility, these women would fall in the category of people getting maybe $8 from this credit and would move into a category of people getting considerably more than that. So we would support making the working family child care credit refundable. We support the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 2.
Thank you very much. Any questions?
Do you have any questions?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair?
Representative Shetland.
When will we see a fiscal impact statement on the Dash 2s?
Mr. Waters, since you just picked up the piece of paper,
yeah,
why don't you have a pistol? Or
yeah.
actually, I've done a little bit of work on this in the past. The Dash 2 amendments don't change the effective date of the Senate Bill 2, so they would only apply to the 2000 tax year on. And they roll back the increase in the income limit from the original bill. I think the annual impact would be in the neighborhood of $12 million per year.
I'm sorry?
$12 million a year. You said $24 million a biennium.
$24 million roughly for a full biennium.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair, is that the... Is that... We already have $15 million on the... This is the revenue impact statement that we got with SB2. Is that in addition to the 15, or is that cumulative?
No, necessarily. That would replace.
Okay.
That, so.
You know, we're actually asking him to do some magic here. I think.
Oh, I understand. I didn't know. I thought maybe since he put the request in that he might be working on this.
He didn't put the request in. Actually, Representative.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
Mm-hmm. He just picked them up. He's just the messenger. So. But we do have this up again tomorrow, so I'm sure you'll have lots of time to work on this. Okay.
Is the reason that the Dash 2s are approximately the same amount as the bill is because the bill expands the credit and this just makes it refundable without expanding it? Is that correct?
Representative Corey, that is correct. It's a pure coincidence that they're close. They're not really that close, but they both increase the amount of credit, but in different ways.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, if I heard you correctly. Oh, okay. Yeah, you're right. They are about the same. Okay. And we'll look for a refinement on that. Anyone else here to speak, testify a public hearing on Senate Bill 2? We do have this up again tomorrow. Okay. Mr. Sangerman, Representative Witt?
And just real quickly, a question for Ed. On the Dash 1s, the Senate Bill 2, the revenue forecast that we had from House Bill 3450 would be identical. Is that correct?
Representative Witt, that is correct. The Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 2 incorporate all of the provisions in House Bill 3450-2, which was the last version of that bill that we considered.
Okay. Any other comments? Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 2. Open public hearing on Senate Bill 244. We have about 6 minutes, Mr. Maneri.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jim Maneri of the Department of Revenue. Senate Bill 244A, and I do have a summary for you.
Okay.
It has to do with property tax exemptions, and there's right now there's four parts to it. The first part in sections 1 and 2 has to do with our centrally assessed program, and it has to do with watercraft. Now, the main watercraft here is tugboats, if you want to get a fix on it. And what you have is every year, in February, they file all the information for us to use in determining value. And then you've provided an exemption. If they have, for instance, the tugboats in dry dock under major repair, then they won't have to pay that year because it's not in service. The reporting for that is April 1st, so they basically have two different deadlines. What this does is changes the law so that they file the information and the application for the exemption on a, for instance, a tugboat and dry dock at the same time. We've checked with the companies, and they support this type of a change, so it's all consistent. That way they're reporting their information on assessable property and information on property that's exempt under this provision. This would change it to February to be filing for both. In Section 3, has to do with has to do with a provision on late filing on exemptions, and it's a provision that where there is a hardship, the late filing can be excused, and the process. And normally, probably the most used on this would be spouses of war veterans that die, and this is an annual application. So what happens is that the war veteran dies, the spouse is supposed to file the application that year, and oftentimes actually the paperwork is delayed by the Veterans Administration beyond the filing date, and so this provision is used. Now what's changed here is it's the three steps. They file with the department, and if we recommend the hardship, it goes to the county assessor, who then has to recommend the hardship, and then it goes to the county governing body that finally approves it. In practice, the county governing body, once it's been approved by the department and the assessor, automatically approve it. And so what we're eliminating is the third step, and that is requiring the county body to, governing body to do that, and the counties are agreeable to this. It really just delays the process. And Section 7 has to do with exemption of years on cemetery property. Most exemptions cover personal and real. For some reason, this statute has only referenced real property. When you're dealing with cemeteries and personal property, you're dealing with shovels and other small items of property. And in practice, the assessors are not picking up this kind of property. So what we're doing is we're changing it to cover real and personal so it matches up with what we're doing in the assessment process.
Potentially a whole new meaning to death taxes. We're just going to bury this provision.
Then sections 4 through 6 were deleted because it was actually covered in an earlier bill that's passed and been signed by the governor. Section 9 and 10 have to do with a situation actually that arose under a Secretary of State's audit, and that has to do with charitable organizations. Current law provides that, and I'll give you the live example, was the Medford YMCA. Current law provides that if they have an exemption, and they either acquire new property or change the use of current property, they're supposed to file an application with the assessor to alert them to that. The law also requires that if they don't file the application, obviously they lose the exemption, not only for the new property, but for all of their property. So the Medford YMCA built a swimming pool, which is an exempt use and would have qualified, but they didn't realize they're supposed to reapply because it's sort of standard kind of property for YMCAs. The Secretary of State, when they did an audit of this program, picked that up and suggested that the result would be that you disqualify all of the Y's property and hit them with back taxes for 5 years, that's why we're bringing this up. We don't think that's the result that's intended. So what we've done is changed this
so that if in fact what happens is the assessor discovers that a charitable organization has either purchased new property and or changed the existing, what happens is they then let the organization file a new application then supporting the exemption and pay a light filing penalty. So if Y built the swimming pool and forgot to file the exemption and the application and the assessor discovered it 2 years later and said, you're supposed to file the application, they can now file it, pay a light filing penalty, and then the assessor can determine whether it's exempt under the law. And if it is, they retain the exemption.
Oh, this sounds retroactive.
This is... Actually, this is retroactive.
Well, see that.
Here, here's an example of a retroactive application of your policy. It's made retroactive to cover the time period that you would roll back taxes under omitted property, 5 years.
Thank you.
That covers the bill.
All right. Thank you. Any questions? okay. Public hearing. Open to work session.
Mr. Chairman.
Senate Bill 244. Representative Witt.
I would move Senate Bill 244A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Witt moves Senate Bill 244A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Rosenbaum, would you carry the bill? Thank you very much.
It's special interest.
Okay, we'll close the work session, Senate Bill 244 members. We're going to have a late session tonight. We've got some bills tomorrow. I'm trying to clear the final House bills. Several committees are already closing down. We still have a few other House bills to move. So since we're going to probably be late tonight, I'd like to move our start time to 8:30, but I'd like to request that you all be here at 8:30 so we can...
I thought we were going until 10 tonight.
Tomorrow morning, Revenue Committee, 8:30.
Oh, I thought you were trying to get a committee session in tonight.
Tomorrow morning.
Oh, okay.
Please be here at 8:30. I'm giving you 15 more minutes. We'll take care of business in the morning.
Use it well.
All right. So please be here. We will adjourn until 8:30 tomorrow.